Hello, lovely listeners out there. Welcome to another fantastic and perhaps even somewhat horrifying, who knows, see what I did there, episode, bonus episode of Oh My Word. And today we have an awesome, incredible, perhaps even horrifying, there we go again, treat, because we have a really, really special guest with us. This is actually someone who, if you remember, just not that long ago, we spoke with Becky Spratford, and I said, Becky, not only are you amazing, do you know other amazing people for me to talk to? And it was almost instantaneous that she was like, you must speak to Jonathan Janz, who is now on with us right now. So welcome, Jonathan, and we are so glad that you are our friend right now.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a blast to be here, and I love what you said about Becky. She's just amazing. What a fantastic person.
Yeah, she really is. And hey, if she knows you, then you must, that's already good qualifications for us. So
I'll take that. Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think an endorsement from her means something at least.
Yeah. Great. So Jonathan writes horror, mainly horror. I think you basically only write horror, or you have horror printed published so far. So we're going to speak to him a little bit about how he got into writing. And for those who know or are a little bit familiar with my work, you know that I don't usually write horror. So this is going to be a very interesting and exciting conversation. And I may or may not be hiding under the bed by the end of it, but we shall find out. So, Jonathan, how did you get into writing or into horror writing specifically? Just in brief, how did you get to where where we're at right now?
Yeah, so Reader's Digest version. When I was little, my mom. So we lived. I just lived with my mom and my cat. It's just the three of us, and we lived next to this graveyard and deep dark woods. And that setting really, I think, kind of predisposed me in the direction of horror. My mom, she was always fond of like the Twilight Zone. She was fond of this show called In Search of ...
Right.
With Leonard Nimoy. And that was always about like the Loch Ness Monster or Dracula or whatever. And so there's frequently horror related things on the television. And then she would get records, albums from the library, like audiobooks basically of like Edgar Allan Poe. So I was listening to The Pit and the Pendulum, The Black Cat, Telltale Heart. I was listening to those when I was 5 or 6 years old.
Wow.
So, I think that was really early. I think I was maybe nudged in that direction. I always wanted to tell stories. I loved movies from an early age, too. And I remember making like 100 movie posters for movies I wanted to make. That was when I was about 7 or 8 or 9. I made the posters, and they were all different genres. But horror, I think, was where I tended the most. And then when I was 18, I got in this really bad car crash. It was near fatal. And I had a computer teacher who knew, so I guess what had happened was, so my basketball career just ended when I was a senior.
Yeah.
And I didn't have anything to do after school. So I started to go to the writing lab after school, and I just started to work on a novel because I discovered the works of Stephen King at age 14 and loved them all the way through high school. And then when I was 18, without anything else to do, I started to write a book. I got into a car crash after I started, but my computer teacher was so cool. He brought this old, it wasn't old at the time, but now it would look like an antique, this Mac out to where I lived so I could continue working on the book.
Oh, wow.
And it was atrocious. It was awful. You know, it was the first attempt, and I was just imitating Stephen King, and very poorly at that, but it was fun, and it was expression, and it was liberation. It's a way I'd never felt before. So I knew at that point I wanted to be a writer. I just knew that I wasn't good enough to do it yet.
Right.
And I kind of set it aside until I was 26, and I started again and tried. I didn't really have the work ethic or the skills. They say you have to write 1 million words before you find your voice. For me, it was like 1.5 million because I'm a slow learner. I'm a late bloomer. But then in my 30s, I started to take it seriously and worked every day. I got rejected by everybody in the world, agents, publishers, random people on the street. And then when I was 37 or so, 38 maybe, I finally got my first real acceptance from editor Don Doria. And nothing about my life has ever been like meteoric or sudden,
right,
as far as success. But slowly since then, this is like early 2012 we're talking, since then it's gotten incrementally better, and it's grown step by step since then.
Wow. Well, do you also see that to be the truth for most writers, is that it's incrementally better? It's not a meteoric rise that we're often led to believe because these big debuts come out and things like that?
That's right. I think that, you know, the big, huge, you know, the six-figure advance straight out of high school or college, that's sexy, right? That,
right.
That's neat. And every writer wants, every person, we all, I think that's just human nature. We want it now.
Right.
You know, it's, I think, Tom Petty said the waiting is the hardest part. And you can apply that to every aspect of life, relationships, jobs, whatever.
Yep.
But I think that the best things are worth waiting for and working toward. And I think that far, far more people who find success, you know, it took them 20 years to be an overnight success, or even 30 years in many cases. So I don't think that my story is unique at all in that way. I just think that I think that perseverance is the most important thing for most of us. There are rare examples that have immediate success, but I think that is really rare.
Right. Well, having been an athlete, does that help? Because being an athlete, you know that even when you're on top of your game, you stop 1 second, someone's going to pass you. Skill is constant.
Yeah, I like that. I think that's true. I mean, I think there are a lot of lessons that I probably learned. I was never an extraordinary athlete. I was a decent high school basketball player, but I do think that, and there are other things, you know, I think for some people it's theater, for
right.
others it's music, whatever, dance maybe.
Right.
But for me, it was athletics that really helped me learn to compete and persevere and power through disappointment. It's funny, I'm sitting here at my son's baseball practice. I'm in the vehicle and he's down on the field, but we were talking about this on the way here. You know, it's not fun is often pretty elusive, you know, but I think what's more important is it worthwhile?
Right.
And I think those experiences were, and I think that this writing pursuit is worthwhile, even though it's not always fun.
Right. Well, then also, this is actually, I'm only thought about this right now, because we've both been published by smaller traditional presses. And if I saw that correctly, and what I realized once is that, well, it took me a while to realize this, is that sure, the smaller presses don't always give you the kind of lights and glamour and even money, whatever that is, you know, of the bigger presses.
Yeah.
But at the same time, sometimes they're more open and more willing to let you try things out, or they're more willing to let you, like, they're just more excited with your storytelling versus like, how much is this going to sell? How much is this, you know, what's it going to look like in the market? And there's more of an allowance for what you can do versus just only thinking about the bottom line, which, you know, because it's a business at the end of the day. I don't know if you've seen that, if that's true or not.
Yeah. All of that is so true. It's so true. And again, that's not sexy.
Right.
But it is so absolutely true. And I think that, you know, that's their story. What we don't hear the shadow side of that six-figure advance out of high school.
Right.
We don't hear how it didn't earn out. We don't hear how no publisher would touch that person because that person was such a risk financially.
Right.
And I think that what you do when you do it this way, if you would have if I would have had the opportunity, I would have leapt for that.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted it right away. I wanted the accolades. I wanted the awards and the money and the glamour and the photo shoots. But the fact is that I wasn't good enough at that time to achieve those things. And then secondly, now looking back, it wouldn't have been the right thing for me. And like you said, I've been able to grow. I've been able to take chances to figure out what works and what doesn't. And that's maybe not the most glamorous path, but I think it's been the right path for me. And I wouldn't be, whatever good I do now as a writer, I wouldn't do had I gone a different way.
Right. And we just want to clarify for any of the money people who are listening that we are always open to the six-figure advance. We just want to make
Absolutely.
That clear. Just in case anyone. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. We'll take payment. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, actually, going back, that you spoke about, like, as soon as you said that you grew up, it was you, your mom, and your cat in the graveyard. I was like, wow, I wonder which story that is. And it's like, oh no, wait, that's your actual real life story. But from other horror writers that you've met, have you found that a lot of them have some sort of, I don't know, either setting or situation like that in common, or, you know, everyone's different, so everyone comes from their own thing?
Yeah, I do. I do find, I guess, both. I find some come from situations similar to mine, and others don't. I do think that, Yeah, I mean, I think that our taste, it's funny that nature versus nurture thing, you wonder how much of that is innate.
Right.
I know, you know, Brian Keene is a good friend of mine, and he's a really acclaimed horror writer, so I know he was really into, like, comics as a kid, and then he got into kind of horror that way to Stephen King. I do think that a lot of people in horror in this particular genre are they kind of feel like outsiders. They've always felt like outsiders.
Right.
In some cases, that's, you know, because they've faced a form of discrimination that I've never faced. Maybe they've faced racial discrimination or discrimination because of who they love or whatever. So I think some gravitate toward it that way, because I think horror is kind of like it's by definition, you know, the one of the genres of the outsider. So people come to horror and they find that everybody feels like an outsider.
Right.
In that way, it's like there's a lot of acceptance. And I love how diverse the genre is. So for whatever reason, maybe it's a body image, maybe it's whatever it is, people feel like they're not accepted. And I think that maybe is also another reason why people go in that direction. Obviously, you can go to other genres for the same reasons.
Right.
But I think that talking to other horror writers, I've found that quite a bit.
That outsiderness. Well, does that kind of, that sets up a little bit of ironic situation, because you're all outsiders, you all go to the one place, but now you're not outsiders anymore because you're all outsiders. So yeah. Unless you're still outsiders within the outsiders, I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's a cool thing. It's like there's a convention called Scares the Care, and
okay.
It's been in Williamsburg every year for the last 7 years. It's canceled this year because they're delayed because of COVID.
Right.
And it's going to be in Wisconsin. It was supposed to be in April, but it got delayed also because of COVID. And I think it'll be in Wisconsin next year and Williamsburg next year. I've just never experienced this pulsing, breathing love in a place as I have there.
Huh.
And I think it's because these people, all of us who have not always been accepted, are. And it's just this incredible, palpable feeling of love and togetherness. And I mean, people walk around all weekend choked up. I do.
Wow.
Because you see these other, you see people that accept you. You know, this is a little bit personal, but I had, when I was a kid, and this is one of the most painful parts of my adolescence,
right.
In high school career, I had this deformity of my chest.
Okay.
And I'm finally working through it now. And in one of my current novels, this book called Halloween Gods, this character is dealing with it. And I would have people like tease me because of it constantly.
Wow.
And it was so painful for me to deal with that. And yet, you know, so I, even though I've not had to deal with other types of prejudice, I have, you know, been bullied before, and I have been, you know, made to feel like the other. And, you know, again, when you're at a convention like that, everybody has gone through something like that, and we all accept each other for who we are, and it's just this really amazing feeling. You know, in the best possible world, everywhere would be like that, but as you and I both know, it's not. You
right.
know, we're often judged harshly because of our differences.
Right. Wow. That's, I don't think anyone would think about that for horror writers. I think everyone's just like, oh, those people.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, damn, yeah.
Exactly.
Which is,
exactly.
Again, like, well, no. So now, speaking about the genre in particular, because especially what some of the things that you've just mentioned about your character going through certain things. So I don't know if it's for you in particular, or you'd say, you know, this can happen a lot in the genre. How much of it is really character driven, and how much of it is really, I just want to scare the pants off you kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, it's probably different for different writers, but for me, the situation plays a large role, but I find that, and I don't know how you feel about characterization, I feel like characters is everything.
Yeah.
I feel like it all hinges on characterization, and great writing, sparkling language, all this stuff, it's important, but I think that without characters in which we can invest, I just feel like that story is dead on arrival.
Right.
So I think that the fact that when you build characters that live and breathe and are relatable or despicable, whatever they are, I think when we're invested in those fates, I think that's what makes the situations so suspenseful. That's what makes them so scary. You know, look at a movie like Jaws. If you don't have somebody like Chief Brody or Matt Hooper or whatever, if you don't care about them, it's just a monster movie.
Right.
But because we so powerfully and deeply want these characters to live and succeed and become better, that's what makes Jaws so nail-biting.
Right. So, because I've seen, like, there's certain either sci-fis or or stories like that that I've read sometimes. And by the time the story is done, I was like, wow, if you strip away the space element, it's just like a regular story, but it becomes sci-fi because we set the story in space. Well, I mean, as far as, you know, this character, it's a story about friendship, but it took place in space. Or it's a story about love, but it took place in space. So do we have that in the horror genre? Can we do that? Or are there building blocks to horror that have to be there that if you strip it away, like, it wouldn't be much of a story anymore?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. Yeah. I do think that if you took away the characterization, it would be hollow, just like with any genre.
Right.
I think with horror, I think that a writer needs to, and this is, again, I don't ever mean to sound disparaging toward other genres because I completely respect them. There are people who look down at romance or people who look down at whatever. There are people who look down at horror.
Right.
Right. So I know how that feels to have my genre bashed.
Right.
I do feel like in horror, you really need to be willing to plumb the depths of what humans are capable of and go there unflinchingly and unblinkingly and report what you find, maybe more than certain other genres, because, you know, this is like a kind of a global statement about life. The more I live, the higher I think the ceiling is for human behavior and the lower the floor.
Right.
And I think that and really honestly, because the floor is so low, and when you go there, I think that's what makes us also able to show the incredible beauty and nobility and love that people are capable of.
Right.
I think horror is largely one that's about love. It's about love surviving through these horrific behaviors and events. I think that, you know, horror is notable because of that depthless floor and that limitless ceiling.
Oh, wow. Well, so does that mean that a lot of horror writers would be really into, if a lot of horror writers would be really into either like forensic psychology or criminal mastermind sort of situation, or it's not necessarily that? It's just it's more of an exploration of a darker side of humanity, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's both. I think that they'd be interested in that aberrant side of psychology and behavior. But I also think what's fascinating is when you put people that we know into those situations, right? So the reader can see himself or herself mirrored and oh my gosh, how would I behave?
Right.
Right. I am Lucy in this scene. I'm inhabiting her body and her headspace, or right. I am Joe in this scene. And I think that's what's really fascinating is when you see people, because I think that we fear what we would do in those situations, but there's this desire, hoping we would feel we would behave in these situations a certain way.
Right.
And we get to see both of those. We get to see our darkest fears played out, like, oh my gosh, yeah, I'd probably do that. I'd probably fail that miserably.
Right.
But then we also get to see, I guess, go through these test run simulators of heroism and feel like, oh my gosh, maybe, yeah, that's what I'd do that. I would step in and intervene in that situation. So in that way, it's very edifying to read horror.
Well, it sounds like a lot of things you're describing are probably more of a psychological sort of horror than like a jump scare type. Or do all of them kind of have both, or those are different branches within horror? Like, some are all about the jump scare and some are about just getting into your head and just creeping you out.
Yeah. And I think the thing with a jump scare is that it's a successful jump scare really shows that technique. That's where I think that's where you get into the craft a little bit more. You're invested in a character, but to make a reader really jump and shriek or gasp or whatever, that's where I think that's where a writer really has to hone her or his or their skill. And I think that takes a lot of time. I wasn't able to do that very well when I was 26 or even 36, but right. I feel like now I feel like I'm much more able to do that, almost like in this Hitchcockian way,
right,
to kind of play your audience. It sounds manipulative and maybe a little like negative, but I think readers want that to a degree. They want it to be done skillfully. We've all seen movies where it's just jump scare after jump scare, and we're just exhausted and annoyed.
We're not
truly frightened.
Right.
But I think that with a great director or a great author in this case, I think that skill really shines through. You know, you do it selectively and you do it properly and you do it in a creative way that maybe hasn't been done before.
Yeah. Well, I guess that also shows how elements of suspense or like thriller would come in to writing a horror, because you set it up you'd have to be able to set up that suspense to get the jump scare to work. You can't just throw yes. things at someone or there's no scare. There's no jump.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that's really where we get this cross pollination. There are a lot of authors that are fantastic. They're not horror, obviously, but they're fantastic at suspense. They're so good. Gillian Flynn.
Right.
Is so good at suspense. Caroline Kepnes, she's extraordinary suspense. You look at writers in other genres. Then, like, I look at Cormac McCarthy in the Road and in his westerns. I think he's really adept at suspense. So I think that's where you start to see that craft is really kind of, I think, with the best of the best in whatever genre you're talking about, I think that's part of that toolbox. I think a lot of writers in different genres are great at that. It's just something that horror writers, maybe it's even more important in their genre because maybe it's expected and it's, when you're going to have something menacing, it's going to jump out at you at some point, right?
Right,
so
right.
It's an essential skill for a horror writer.
Well, does that go with the whole, I'm blanking on the name now. The whole, if there's a Chekhov's pistol, the revolver, like there's a gun in scene one, it's got to go off by act three, or in act one, it's got to go off by act two or three or whatever.
Yeah. I think so. I think there needs to be a payoff. I think that
right.
Kathy Bates in Misery, it's probably in the book version too, but I've seen the movie more recently than the book, but
right.
she keeps telling Paul Sheldon, the James Caan character, she keeps saying, don't cheat. You have to bring misery back to life, but you can't cheat.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's the thing. I think that you cannot cheat the reader. I mean, the best writers, when I read the best writers, they give me credit for having a brain.
And
it's not condescending. And that's part of this pact, this covenant between reader and writer. I think when we find our favorite writers, they're the writers that understand that, we get it. We know. You don't have to poke us in the ribs over and over. We get it. We understand what's happening. And part of that covenant is trusting that reader and then also fulfilling your end of the bargain. You can't just throw things in lazily or sloppily or hoping the reader will forget about what happened on page two. You need to honor that. You need to hold up your end of the bargain by letting there be a payoff and then doing that skillfully.
Oh, absolutely. Well, so you did mention some of the writers that you mentioned. So does this, I don't know if you give a percentage or a basic amount, how much of what you read is either horror, read or watch is horror, and how much of it are you actually looking outside your genre to just either see what's out there because you enjoy all the other stuff that's out there?
Yeah, that's a great question. And here's the thing. It's like I've heard two pieces of advice and I agree with both of them. I've heard write what you know and then write what you don't know. And I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think they're both right. And I think the same thing with how you read. I've read very widely over the course of, I didn't read a book until I was 14.
Oh,
Cause I thought I was stupid. I thought I was incapable.
Oh, right.
And then I found that writer who didn't make me feel stupid. That was Stephen King.
Uh-huh.
And he's the reason why I'm a reader. I'm a writer, I'm a teacher because of Stephen King.
Yeah.
And so I think that when you, I just totally, I you're going to be mad, you're not going to be mad at me because I'm talking advice. I lost the thread kind of what you asked because I started thinking about Stephen King. Tell me what the question was again, sorry.
I was asking about what genres you read.
Yes, sorry, there we go. I'm so sorry. I was adrift in adolescence. Scary place. No. So I've read, between the ages of 14 and now, I've read everything. I've read very, very widely. Now, just to be honest, I read more horror than anything. I'd probably say like 60% of what I read is horror and 40% other genres. In my movie viewing, though, I am as apt to watch a musical or a comedy or a romance or adventure or sci-fi as I am horror. So really, I watch everything pretty evenly. I watch martial arts. I watch, not as many documentaries, but a few. So with movies, I watch very, very widely, very voraciously. And in books, I read voraciously, but I definitely tilt more toward horror now. Maybe because I'm kind of in that craft place when
right.
I read.
Right.
I don't read just for fun that much anymore. I read because I want to get better, because I want to look at how this writer does it. And obviously, to read for craft, you need to read widely, too. I read other genres. But yeah, I mean, when I read Stephen King now, there's that mercenary side of me. I'm like, okay, how are you going to do this, Stephen? And I look back, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a neat way to do it. Now, that doesn't work for me, but I might do it this way and take a little of that flavor and make it work.
That is, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think a lot of people don't appreciate how much reading you have to do as a writer, which is something I think all writers are like, read, read.
If you don't, this King said this. He said, if you don't have time to read, you don't have time to write. I believe that wholeheartedly. I think it is half the equation. And I think that, you've got to read constantly, you've got to write constantly. Those are the two constants that you must do. And not necessarily, when I say constantly, during the school year when I teach, I don't write as much new stuff. I do a lot of my editing during the school year, and then I do a lot of writing in the summer. Uh-huh. So I'm not saying that you have to be on a specific schedule, but just in general, you do have to read a lot, and you do have to write a lot, I believe, to be your best.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, so I have one more question about the genre writing, and actually do want to ask a little bit about being a teacher. So when you're approaching, I don't know if you have a rule for this, but when you're approaching the story, do you sometimes think, okay, I want to write, a love story, a story about friendship, whatever it's going to be, that's going to survive all odds. So now I'm just going to throw a bunch of stuff at it. Or do you think, wow, that's so creepy. Who can I put into that creepy moment or something like that?
Yeah, it's always different. And this is what I love about, at least my process, is every book is different and every process is slightly different. Generally speaking, like when we get into theme, that comes out like subconsciously, and I'm not even often aware of it. Usually I'm not aware of it until editing.
Right.
I'm like, oh my gosh, that's what this book is about. and then you can really shine that and hone that. Sometimes, and this makes me sound pretty foolish maybe, but sometimes I'm not even aware of a theme until after a book is published.
Oh, wow.
And then one example of that, I wrote this book called The Siren and the Spectre. Right. It's one of my most successful books. And I was at Scares of Care on this panel, and I was talking about Siren and the Spectre, and I didn't even realize how much of me was in this specific character, and how it was almost like this act of attempted contrition and atonement.
Wow.
For this behavior that I had kind of exhibited earlier in my life. Not to get too far into this, because I don't want to get us too far afield, but
yeah.
I at one point in my life was just like, okay, I'm just going to be honest with the young women that I date. This is in my early 20s. But I'm not going to settle down. I'm just going to tell them I'm not interested in anything like long term. And, even though I was honest about it, that doesn't mean that that was necessarily nice.
Right. Yes.
That doesn't mean that that was necessarily an honorable way to behave, because, you can tell somebody I'm not interested, but then when you act out all the accoutrements of romance, then they're going to maybe get invested, and then there's still emotional harm done when you pull away.
Yeah.
And just because you said that you were going to pull away doesn't mean that that's fair or right or the right thing to do as a human being. So I was talking about this on this panel. I started to cry.
Oh, wow.
I started to think of the emotional damage that I had done to a few young women, thinking that I was, doing okay. And I really realized that I wasn't. And led me to call and send emails, and not that I, anyway, the whole point is that, I think that all this subconscious stuff, it's going to find its way into the page, but often it's done without our really realizing it.
Right. Well, I guess that also shows how it doesn't necessarily matter the genre that you're writing in. When you're writing about people, you're going to find, I guess, something universal about your story. You're going to be able to find something that's real, and it doesn't matter how much you make up around that story. I guess,
yes,
that makes sense.
That's absolutely right. And I think in terms of the publishing industry, when you get into the finances and stuff, I think they often talk about that crossover appeal or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think that's really what crossover is. I mean, because you talk about that, they can say, well, this book was a crossover success and this book, and they're completely different books, right?
Right.
They have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah.
And so, when you're looking for the secret sauce, I think that the things that we're talking about, that's the secret sauce. It's that people can really identify, like, oh man, like that hits close to home. I feel her. I feel that.
Right.
And I think that's why it's something that's not at all unique to horror. I think it's unique to great storytelling, and that's what makes it a crossover.
Yeah. Well, that's a Becky had made a comment that she really doesn't like when publishers try to add literary, let's say, in front of horror or any other thing, because she's like, well, what's all the other stuff then? So how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think there's a fine line between literary and pretentiousness. You know, and I can say that because I wrote pretentiously from the ages of 26 to 32 because I wanted to be perceived as intelligent.
Right. Okay.
And I can admit that now, but I would put this polysyllabic word
right.
where it didn't belong.
Right.
And I think that there are a lot of writers who just so badly want to be seen, want to be included in this rarefied air, this esteemed company, this august company, that they kind of forget that there are other things than that. And here's the thing. I think you probably agree. I don't think it's mutually exclusive.
Right.
There's a writer named Robert McCammon in the horror community. That guy is this old world craftsman of such amazing storytelling, melded and buried to such beautiful language.
Right.
It just sparkles. It is absolutely literary, though some might not call it that because it's also entertaining, and some see those as mutually exclusive.
Right.
And I just feel like they're depriving themselves of some fantastic books.
Yeah.
Like they can only find books that are labeled literary, and that if it's somehow popular, well then it's no longer in my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
I think it's just a very limited way to approach.
Well, yeah, because I've seen that sometimes from sports writers or people like that, that they're like, oh, because sports writing is not considered literary, so
mm-hmm.
you know they're never going to be nominated for the Man Booker Prize, even though what they're writing is high quality writing. But because
yes.
it doesn't fall into the neat little category, you know, they kind of get overlooked because like, oh, you're a sports writer, not you're a writer and you're writing about sports. Kind
exactly,
of
exactly, yeah. And they get painted with that unliterary brush. You know, people turn up their noses sometimes, and like you talked about, great writing is great writing.
Yeah,
you know, whether it's a journalism or a novelist or a poet, you know, great writing is great writing, and I think that it's really just unfortunate to cling to that notion. I'm glad that finally I was disabused of it, but I can tell you, I was guilty of it for a time.
Wow. Okay. There's so much more to say on this, but we do have to. We sort of do have to wrap up, but I do want to ask about being a writing teacher. So,
sure.
What sort of age group do you work with, or do all age
yeah.
groups, or what is it? Yeah.
Yeah. So I teach at the junior senior high, and
okay.
I teach eighth graders, and then I teach classes with sophomores, juniors, and seniors. So basically 14 through 18 mainly. So I teach creative writing, English to eighth graders, then to the high school kids. I teach advanced creative writing and film literature.
Okay. So I'm assuming that, or I'm going to guess that not all the kids in the class are either writing types or reading types or whatever, but so what do you want them, like when you come to this, what do you want them to actually get out of the class? Is it just, I want you to love storytelling, or I just want, like, you may never be a writer, you may never be a reader, but I want you to leave the class with a new appreciation for X.
Yeah, no, the three words I write on the board on the first day of class, I write, find your voice. And I think expression, I think the act of putting pen to paper or fingers to keyboard, however you do it,
right.
I think that there is so much value in that. And I think that I honestly believe this. I think the more we express, I mean, I'm not trying to like, you know, reduce therapy, an entire field to this.
Right.
But I think, just that's one of the reasons why people are, they see therapists, because there's value in getting it out. There's value in talking. And I think that the more we bottle, I think the more difficult life sometimes is. And so I think that just the act of getting those words out, whatever they are, ungrammatical, you know, the word choice is not diverse, whatever, as long as you're getting words out, I think that you become an emotionally and mentally healthier person.
Right. Well, so I once told someone who kind of made a comment about reading, and I said, part of reading is that you learn new words to know how to express yourself, because you're just always going to use the word happy instead of joyful, excited, you know, ecstatic. You have such a range within happy, but if you're only
yes.
ever going to say you're happy, you're not fully saying where you're at. So
no, that's so true. And you know, another, to piggyback on that, another thing that reading does is, you know, we're so in our own heads, right?
Oh, yeah.
it's not natural
oh,
to
yeah.
see through your eyes or through my wife's eyes or through my kid's eyes. That's not natural. That takes effort because we are, I think, by nature egocentric. And when you read, you are inhabiting somebody else's headspace. And what often happens there is you see their problems and you start to have more empathy for people in the real world because you start to think like these other characters. And then also you see people having problems that you have and you realize you're not as broken as you thought you were.
Right.
Or if you are, you're no more broken than everybody else. And I think that is so healthy and invigorating and buoying to realize. And that's one thing that fiction does.
Right. Well, that goes back to the convention. I've actually seen study. I don't know. It might have been a bias study, but it was about how fiction readers are often more empathetic people because of what you've just listed. So yeah.
I bet it's true.
Yeah. Of course it's going to be true. We'll just decide it's true. No, I think it's a real, it was a real study that I saw. But so does that mean, just going back to that, you're telling your students that they have to find their voice and things like that. Does that mean that you are of the opinion that it doesn't matter what you're either reading or writing as long as you're doing it? Because some people, now I think a lot of people are coming around to it, but it used to be like, oh, a comic book is not real reading. It's like, well, if that's what the kid likes, then let him read it. Why are you forcing him to read, you know, Where the Red Fern Grows if he's not connecting to it? I don't know.
That's,
what do you think about
so
that?
So true. I totally, you're speaking my language. I totally believe that. I totally believe if a kid wants to read a graphic novel, let the kid read it. The kid's reading, using his own imagination. That's amazing, right?
Right.
If a kid wants to write a manga or to write, and that's why I always, like, even in my English class, and this probably is heresy to a lot of English teachers.
Yeah.
I'll give a journal entry, which will require like 175 words or whatever. I'll have a student do it in free verse, right? And do it in poetry.
Oh.
I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. And yeah, of course we study grammar and other things too at times, but you know, you find, I love it when an assignment also allows for that expression and that creativity. I never want my students to write like each other. I never want them to try to sound like me.
Right.
I want them to find their own voices. I want them to sound like themselves and find what they like to read. I think that's because what my grandfather, he read the newspaper, you know, and that's kind of dull to some people, but he read that newspaper. He's 95 and his mental acuity is just razor sharp.
Wow.
Because he, you know, what if he would have been told, well, that's a waste of time to read the sports page.
Right.
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 But I think that's largely why he's still so, you know, vigorous and, you know, mentally able and intellectually capable at age 95.
Well, would you allow, have you ever allowed someone to actually, someone who had, was more autistic to kind of write in a graphic novel kind of format? Would you allow that?
Oh, absolutely.
That's
I let
great.
Them write for sure. I whatever kind of stuff they want to write, I allow them to. I encourage that. I just think that's the thing. It's like people, you know, I've never been in an MFA program.
Okay.
And I would guess that an MFA program is as, I think that would be the litmus test. Like, what is the goal? Are you putting people in the situation where there's pressure to be, to find this sameness, right? If you are pressuring people to sound like other people or holding them up to some really silly standard, I would guess that's a destructive program. But if you're, yeah, I mean, of course there are best practices that most of us would, you know, showing, not telling, all
yeah.
this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, but, yeah, you need to learn the rules, of course, but,
right.
but that doesn't mean that you always have to adhere to them.
Exactly.
But I think that an MFA program that would allow for that differentiation and encourage that diversity of expression, I think that could probably be a wonderful program.
Right. Well, speaking of knowing the rules and breaking them, I think one of my greatest moments as a writer was starting a sentence with like because or but
Boom.
Or and. Yeah. I was like, yeah, you can do this.
Exactly, right? I mean, there's a time and place for everything.
Yeah. Well, just again, there's so much to speak on this, but if you could just, I don't know if you could choose one moment or you could say one of my greatest moments as a teacher at the end of the year was when a student said X, came to the realization of X, something with a student. Do you have something on hand that you can share like that?
Yeah, I do. And I don't mean to sound, because I know that I'm you know, just I'm just one person in the grand scheme of things. I don't look at myself, and I don't think I am in any way exceptional or anything like that. But I do think that we influence each other, and I think we affect each other, and I think that we often underestimate the impact we have on each other's lives. And that's not just in the field of education. It's just, you know, when we, you know, if you see somebody on the street, I think that you can impact that person. Yeah. And I, you know, it's funny, I've been teaching now for this is going to be my 25th year, not counting student teaching. Yeah. And, you know, when students tell me that they, you know, I've had so many students talk about how they were suicidal.
Oh, wow.
And they just needed somebody. You know, it's neat when a student says, you helped me become a writer, you helped me do this or that. But I think it's more important when a student says, you made me feel important. You know, you made me feel like I mattered. Wow. I'm sorry if I'm choking up here, but, you know, I just think that we take for granted how lonely people can be. We take for granted how alone people can feel, how lost people can feel, you know, and teachers, that's why, you know, I think there are a lot of teachers who know their subject area, but they don't belong within 1,000 feet of a kid because they don't do it with heart.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that you have to care. You have to remember that your words and actions are going to influence these young people. Because I think we're always at a tender age and a tender stage, you know, regardless of our age, but especially when you're in that like adolescent period, when you're 17, 18, 13, 14, man, you can shatter somebody with a word. You can crush somebody, but at the same time, you can give someone hope. You can show that, you know, there's something special in them. And I think that when you have a kid come back and tell you that, and you know, most often you don't realize that a kid's struggling or suffering.
Yeah.
And then you find out later on that the kid was, and sometimes it's just as simple as saying hi to the kid on the way in the door or talking to the kid, you know, just briefly. You know, I think that those things as an educator mean far more than any writing technique or film term or grammatical lesson.
Oh, absolutely. Well, against my will, I'm going to wrap this up, even though I really don't want to. But I did, like I said, I always like to end with asking if you could fill in the blank of, I love it when writers or stories or publishers do X. And then even the flip side of that, like, I can't stand it when they do X.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really like it when, this sounds cheesy, but I've already gone into complete cheese land last comments. I love it when people are kind to each other and try to lift each other up. You find a lot of people, like, you know, there's a ladder metaphor that I'm going to butcher here, but it's like the ladder. You find people who, when they attain whatever level of success, that they kick that ladder out from under them.
Right.
And they, or they'll step on people's hands, or they'll elbow people off the ladder on their way up. There are a lot of people like that. There are a lot of people, unfortunately, who are pretty cruel and pretty selfish and nasty. And I've encountered those. So that's what I hate. But man, I love it when I encounter, and I'm thankful to say that so many people, like Josh Malerman, author of Bird Box, over the past year, he and I have become really good friends. And he's this guy, he'll just do anything for you. He'll give you the shirt off his back. Caroline Kepnes has become a friend, and she's the same way. She's so kind and so humble, and she's rooting for me to succeed.
Right.
Joe R. Lansdale's had movies and TV shows made out of his stuff, and he's this guy. Even before I got a single thing published, he would answer every Facebook message. He always treated me like somebody, even when I didn't feel like anybody. When I felt like nobody, he treated me like somebody. And Brian Keene's another person. So I just love it when people are generous and caring. And, you know, the antithesis of that is unfortunate. But I find much more good than bad, I'm happy to say.
That is fabulous to hear. Okay, thank you, John. Thank you so much for your time and for coming on with us. This is fantastic. Thank you so much.
Well, it's been an honor to talk to you. I really appreciate it. It's been amazing. And you've been amazing, and I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Shucks. All right, very good.